Thank you, everyone. We're going to go ahead and get started. Called to order the Joint Committee on Public Safety. Thank you for being here this afternoon. Today we have three presentations that are informational only. First, we're going to be hearing from Craig Prince, who's going to be going through sentencing for drug and property offenders, covering Measure 57, issues regarding the proposals on the restructuring of marijuana, as well as for sentencing purposes, as well as the driving while suspended. We'll also be hearing from Judge Dennis Graves regarding the drug and mental health courts. And lastly, we will also be hearing from on the specialty courts from Honorable Judge Nan Waller. So thank you, everyone, for being here. Craig, why don't you go ahead and come on up. And Josh, do you want to give us any type of overview, or is there a need to?
Co-chairs, members of the committee, as you may recall, we had a riveting discussion last week, and I think we covered sort of the broad strokes, and so I think Mr. Prince is going to use a smaller brushstroke.
All right. For procedural purposes, we'll open up the informational meetings, and the first, as I said, will be a presentation by Mr. Prince.
Thank you, co-chairs, members of the committee. My name is Craig Prinz. I'm the executive director of the Criminal Justice Commission. Thank you, Josh, for setting that up. We're going to look at three sections of your bill, the House Bill 3194, and then I'm going to hand it off to the judges to talk about one of the key reinvestments, kind of why we're doing these sentencing changes. In the governor's budget, a $9 million allocation to drug courts. So Judge Graves can talk through, and Judge Waller can talk through those from their perspectives. So that's what we wanted to do today. These slides were presented to a lot of you during the summer of 2012. The first slide, I think, will be familiar, but basically what this is showing is that Oregon has always used probation for our nonviolent offenders. So those who possess drugs, for example, almost all of them are handled in probation. And if they don't do well on probation, they go to jail, and they do not make it to state prison. And you can see that over the last decade, there's been a growth in the percentage of felons that have gone to prison, and that has been part of what has caused that increase in our use of prison over the last decade, and that is what we are anticipating will accelerate as we go into 13-15. That 18% growth in convicted felons who go to prison, 90% of that is those convicted of nonviolent offenses, property, other, or drug-type offenses. These would be drug sales, drug manufacturing, but it is not, most of that new growth is not in sexual or person offenses. You can see that this is basically showing that just in another chart. Actually, when you look at our prison population, who was in prison a decade ago in 2000, 29% were person felons. And now we've got 26% are there because they committed a person crime. In 2000, 18% were sex offenders. In 2011, it's 15%. So that shows that move toward using incarceration more for the drug and property and other, and away from those areas that we've kind of prided ourselves on in Oregon and what's made us a model state for using our prisons for the most serious violent and sexual offenders. When we look at this chart, it's showing the length of stay, LOS. This is the time an offender would be serving in prison on a drug crime in the light blue and a property crime in the dark blue. So 1.8 years would be about 21 months. What this is showing is the length of stay increase is what's been increasing our use of prisons. For drug offenders, the length of stay has increased 22%, and for property offenders, it's an increase of 7% over that time. And again, we think that this continued increase in length of stay will accelerate. So when we talk about that use of incarceration, two things to think about. The use of incarceration is something that many studies have shown has an impact on crime and decreases crime, especially when we look at how it was used in the 90s when we used it for violent and sexual offenders. And some studies would show it had up to a 30% effect in our crime rate reductions. So if we reduced our violent crime rate in the 90s of almost, about 50%, that would be about a 15% reduction could be attributable to the use of incarceration. I believe that that's basically incapacitation, meaning those violent and sexual offenders are in prison and they are not able to commit any crimes while they're there. On the other hand, conversely, there's also lots of evidence that shows that incarceration alone does not reduce recidivism. So 95% or whatever, 90 in the high 90s percent of these guys get out of prison. The length of time that they spent in prison does not seem to contribute to recidivism reduction. Really important to point out, we tend to link incarceration and crime like those are the two big things. Crime control is about so many factors. New York control had just as large or a slightly larger reduction in violent crime as Oregon did at a time when they reduced their incarceration. So incarceration's one part. It's a part we look at a lot from the state perspective because it's a part we invest the most dollars in. But certainly policing practices, evidence-based policing, hotspot policing, even things like urban planning, the way we plan our communities, community corrections advancements, the reduction in recidivism, things like the meth issues that we had in the mid-2000s and that we had a crack cocaine epidemic in the 90s. All of those things are factors as to what drives crime up and down. And I wanted to make those points about where incarceration fits into that. Daniel Nagin has done some studies of that, and I think the studies point to one of the keys, and he's one of the national figures. Some people, when we look at the effect of prison, it can cause them to commit more crime, and that would be the lower risk offender, putting that type of offender in prison. There are studies that show for that type of offender, you might be actually making it more likely. And he's looked at that with some random controlled trial studies. And also the length of time for a custodial sanction, like a jail bed, sending someone to jail, the length they serve is not as much of an impact of that swift, sure sanction of a jail bed. And I think Judge Graves, I know, is all too familiar with the drug court model of using those swift sanctions immediately to keep someone from getting into a pattern that they're going to start committing crime again. Also, we're going to look at drug crimes, and keep in mind that in Oregon, most of the drug offenders, when we look at that, it's drug dealers and drug manufacturers. One of the key things we've learned about using incarceration for drug crimes is drug crimes are different from most crimes where the person buying the drug is trying to seek out and find the person who we call the offender. And so we've realized that there's a real replacement factor. In other words, if you put one kid who was selling drugs on a street corner in an urban setting, for example, You're just going to take him off the street, but he's going to be replaced by another low-level drug seller, a retail seller, a hand-to-hand transaction. Very different from when we're trying to interdict, as Representative Olson, when he worked on an interagency narcotics task force, trying to get guys who are bringing in large amounts of drugs in the kilograms or pounds area. You'd want to target on those type of offenders. Briefly, Measure 57 is one of the options to that was put into 39194. I think Joshua went over it last week. or earlier this week, excuse me. Measure 57, there were two portions of that. There was a property crime portion, and the property crime portion of Measure 57, it increased the presumptive sentence length for, these are for property offenders, people who commit forgery, identity theft, unauthorized use of a motor vehicle. And it also made it so you needed fewer prior criminal convictions to qualify for prison. And it also limited a judge's discretion to sentence someone for a shorter prison sentence or to use a probation or a drug court type intervention on an offender who, let's say, doesn't have a long criminal history or maybe for identity theft, for example, a lot of these are committed by women where the county community corrections or court have looked at that individual offender and they've said, we think this is the type of person that could be handled safely in the community. It limited the judge's discretion in those type of cases, but does allow the prosecution to stipulate to probation even where the judge would not be able to if there weren't the findings present that they'd have to make. There's also a drug portion of Measure 57 that created mandatory prison sentences for certain type of drug deliveries and manufacturers based upon the quantity or whether they're a repeat offender. The key for Measure 57, it was in effect from January 2009 to early 2010 for crimes committed on or after January 2009. And then it was suspended, those portions that are for the property and drugs. And it then came back to full effect January 1, 2012. And we're just, I think, as you look at how long it takes someone to get into prison who committed a crime, we're just starting to get into where the bulk of the type of offenders who were committing their crimes in January, February, March of last year would now be coming to prison. So what all this means for the prison growth that has been identified as the governor's focus on this to try to alleviate is 62% of the prison growth that we've looked at over the next 10 years is kind of all of our policies that happened up to 2008. So this is that conversation of what got us to 14,200 beds today is mostly all the things we've done up to this point. Sentencing guidelines, Measure 57, or Measure 11, local control, repeat property offender, that's all kind of, that's 62% of the growth in the next 10 years. And then you could see Measure 57 has really the bulk of the rest of it is in the drugs and property portions of Measure 57. This graphically shows kind of how that growth would take place. I think the key, I know from the Department of Corrections and the Ways and Means perspective, is most of that growth occurs by July 1, 2015. And that's what Senator Winters and Representative Barker and all of those who are on Ways and Means, when you're setting the prison budget for the next biennium, you're going to look at their caseload growth by July 1, 2015, the end of the biennium. And you can see it, I think I don't have the exact figure, but it's nearly 1,000 beds. Oh, 800 beds, excuse me, by 2016. And then the total beds are right around that, too. So the modification in 3194 would be to have, instead of what we've got currently, what we would do is we would keep in place the portion of Measure 57 that allows a repeat offender to go on their second offense. We would keep that in place, but we would let the judge have a range of what the presumptive sentence would be, and this would, we think, get right at that length of stay issue that we brought out in the earlier slides. We would maintain the Measure 57 mandatory first sentences for drug dealers who target minors. And we would also maintain it for the higher ranges for the drug traffickers who are using or are selling quantities of drugs that I talked about earlier. This would be prospective. There are no resentencing portions of 3194. This would be for folks sentenced after the date of the bill. And the prison bed impacts are there just to give you a basic idea of the bed impacts. Keep in mind, we're going to have to look at the whole policy you put together, because some of these impacts are going to, you know, some of these changes would impact the same offenders. We want to make sure we're not double counting the impacts. Briefly, the marijuana offenses, what we would do there in the bill, and Josh went over this, is we would increase the presumptive probation for marijuana sentences in the lower range, and we would keep the prison resources focused on those who are actually traffickers of commercial weights of marijuana. And this would be prospective as well, and really would put us in line with the federal guidelines, where they look at the weights in the same manner. And my last slide is to look at driving while suspended. This is one of the crimes, when we looked at the earlier slides, would be an other type crime. And this would just move driving while suspended down on the guidelines so that it would be a presumptive probation crime. That type of offender would be looking at a jail sentence in their local jail, not prison. And you can see the impacts there. With that, I'm happy to answer questions, and would say, you know, keep in mind that all of these things are then to give the flexibility so that these type of offenders can be looked at in a drug court type program, or a means to an end to get the money to get the reinvestment.
Sure.
Yes.
Could we just go back two slides? I wanted to write a couple notes. Thanks. Bed impacts.
Mr. Chair, okay, Craig, on the numbers for the next three slides that you have, those are new numbers, aren't they? You've crunched those a little differently, because I don't remember those specifically before.
They might be slightly different, okay, based upon the way Josh drafted the bill and the way we looked at it. So I'll have to check, Representative. And keep in mind, the individual ones, I can't stress that enough, when we get the full package together, you know, for example, we don't want to double count an earn time and a length of stay on this together. But I'll huddle in the back and see if I can answer your question on whether those were changed from the last you've seen them.
Okay,
and
thank
why.
You.
Mm-hmm. Thank
other
you.
Questions, comments? Letting it all be absorbed. Still no questions, still no comments. Craig, thank you.
Thank you.
Was that sent to us, by the way?
I think so, and we certainly can have it on the...
It should be, yeah, it should be up.
It's on there.
It's on there.
It's on the list.
I'm still learning how to use that.
Me too.
It's not easy.
Just not easy at all.
Not user-friendly.
All right, so...
Both judges, y'all want to come up together? That would be great.
That's nice.
So our next two presenters are going to be Judge Graves and Judge Waller. They will be talking again about drug mental health courts as well as specialty courts. And Your Honors, thank you very much for being here once again.
Thank
and we'll
you.
Let you present in whatever order you'd like to.
Thank you. Co-chairs, members of the committee, my name is Dennis Graves. I'm a circuit court judge in Marion County. I'm just beginning my 14th year. My first year in 1999 was an assignment involving criminal cases only. Meth was kind of at its peak, and I was seeing people come in for sentencing, and then I'd see them frequently on probation violations because they weren't doing their treatment, they weren't checking in with their probation officer, they weren't maintaining current addresses. And so looking at that problem, I began looking around for some different way of handling those kinds of people. And that's when I learned about the drug court model, and we actually implemented our drug court in 2001. So we're just about ready to have a 12th anniversary. I can tell you that We also have a mental health court, which I'll speak to briefly, and then we have a family attachment treatment court, which is focused on dependency cases, juvenile dependency cases. We have a teen drug court and a beginning of a veterans court. Essentially, I think we've all looked at this issue of crime and how can we deal with it in the least of, in the most cost-effective manner, and yet promote and continue community safety. And I can tell you that of all the practice that I have as a judge, I think this is the most proven effective model for people that have been screened by the district attorney's office for entry and then participate in the drug court model. It requires intense involvement by the court and the team members. We started with four team members in 2001. We now have 15. Essentially, we're collaborating, we're working together. We're all of the people are public employees, but for some private volunteers. And I'm confident that the decisions I make are greatly enhanced by the advice and wisdom of the people that are on the team. We, as I said, established our drug court in 2001 because I had learned that punishment when it comes to addiction just doesn't work. And so after we received some training, we began our process, and it's just the most life-giving work I think a judge can do. There was a study done that you are familiar with that was commissioned by the Criminal Justice Commission, and it can provide you with, and I can answer some questions about its evidence in terms of our effectiveness. We have, as a result of that study, and I'll tell you right now, we have 41 people in drug court and 9 people waiting. The funding we have for treatment comes from you all, and through the Criminal Justice Commission, we can pay for 25 slots of individuals in outpatient treatment using our state grant funds. The treatment provider we're working with will also accept people that have OHP, and the billing then goes to OHP. So one way or the other, state government dollars are paying for probably the most of it. The results, we've had a total of 393 people in drug court. Like I said, we have 41 right now. And our graduation retention rate, that is, including the people that are in the court now and those that have graduated compared to those that were terminated or opted out of the court, is just above 70%. In terms of the effect on controlling recidivism, which we all know has big dollar signs attached to it, our first-year graduates comparing arrest, not conviction, because in drug court world, the test for recidivism is arrest, and that's any arrest. Our drug court showed a 69% reduction in recidivism after 1 year compared to a like-kind control group. After 2 years, a 63% reduction, and after 3 years, a 53% reduction. And so those rates total up to be significant, I think, in terms of cost effectiveness. We would be treating more people if we had the ability, and that's driven by cost in terms of the focus that you have in allocating state resources, and also judicial time. I started doing the drug court just in addition to the rest of my docket, because I believed in it and I felt that it was important. And I now receive a 2-case adjustment per week for doing drug court. I'm in court for a half day a week, and otherwise I have a docket like everyone else. Mental health court was started in 2006, and it was started, again, I was involved in starting it. I never received any case reduction because that wasn't my motivation. My motivation was helping the sheriff, who was having so many people come through the jail on a repeated basis. We had one individual we accepted into drug court, mental health court, and graduated, who'd been incarcerated 68 times. Many of these people, like the individual I was facing yesterday in mental health court, has 10 pending charges, and they all relate to criminal trespass, disorderly conduct, the kinds of charges you routinely see from people who have mental illness, perhaps receive medication and then become convinced after they're feeling better they don't need the medication, and so they stop taking it. They often self-medicate with street drugs, in particular marijuana. And so it's, even though we're dealing with them in mental health court, we have co-occurring disorders, not only between the mental health and the drug, but in drug court we have the same situation in terms of co-occurring disorders. 72% of our participants in drug court currently have co-occurring disorders and are receiving either medication management or counseling through the various resources that we've been able to kind of best utilize the funds we have and obtain. Our focus in drug court is a focus on parents whose children have been removed or DHS has been involved. And our goal is to have an effect, of course, on the parents, but also be able to have those children restored back to their parents sooner rather than later, thus reducing the cost of child welfare and preserving that family if we can, assuming the parents respond appropriately to treatment. And so the numbers that I gave you include that as a primary focus. We also have people who are parents, but their children are with another individual under guardianship, or perhaps their former spouse or significant other has legal custody, and we require those people to do a parenting class, which without exception, even though they drug their feet and didn't want to go, have all told me that they really found it beneficial. Many of our people, because they started using drugs early, did not graduate from high school, and so we require them to get a GED in order to graduate unless they have a disability that would prevent that from happening. And currently we have 89% of the people that have graduated have gotten a GED because they've been able to. The others were accepted because of essentially low intelligence. And we also require people in order to graduate to be in college. They have to have a GED. They have to be in college full-time or employed. So we essentially take people that come in who are significant users of public dollars and turn them into taxpayers. We see self-esteem go up miles. We see parents who get their kids back so overjoyed that it's just wonderful to see. Those kids often come to court because I have fruit snacks that I keep for kids on the bench. And at first I thought it might kind of help me with the parents, but it's just fun with the kids. It truly is. So I can clearly say that over this period of time, this innovative kind of a court that is, incidentally, Multnomah County's was the first or second in the nation, has been highly effective. In terms of mental health court, our focus is primarily helping the individual with mental health stability and keeping them off drugs so that they don't go back into the jail repeatedly. It's amazing how many people come to us and don't have treatment. And the sad answer we have for them is, I'm sorry, we can't help you, because we do not have any funding for mental health court, and haven't ever. But the health department is one of the team members in mental health court. And so when that happens, we usually look over at the county health department and say, what can you do? And most times they've been able to help us. Housing is also a critical issue with people that are mentally ill and or are using drugs. Probably those that are in mental health court, I would say at least 80% of them use drugs as well. And so trying to determine whether the individual should go to mental health court or drug court is always the balance. You know, is this person so mentally ill they can't go through drug court successfully, or are they so drug affected they really can't effectively go through mental health court till we get their addiction under control? And so that balancing goes on day in and day out in both of those courts, and it's a matter of judgment and the wisdom that we receive from other team members that I think helps us with the best decisions we could make. If we had funding for a mental health court, of course, we could have a single treatment provider at the table, or maybe two, and we'd be getting feedback on how the individual is doing in treatment, like we do in alcohol and drug issues with drug court. We also have two beds for people that have intensive problems with co-occurring disorders, and we utilize those funds usually early in the biennium. And so we're cautious about whom we refer to that, but it is effective, certainly, but requires more expense in terms of that particular treatment. I'd be happy to answer any questions for you.
I think we'll go ahead and take questions now for Judge Graves so he can move on if he has other obligations. And if you can stay, that'd be great, too. But first I had Representative Garrett and then Senator Close.
Thank you, Judge. Could you say a little bit more about the funding, how the funding works for the drug court? You mentioned being reliant on state dollars. I understand that some or all of that funding is set to expire. The governor's budget calls for some reinvestment. Just kind of give us an overview of how this works financially.
I can. We receive funding from the Criminal Justice Commission, and then courtesy of Senator Winters and Mr. Prinz, we were able to keep our drug court open 2 years ago by virtue of some help that they provided. We have state funding of $193,158. That's for the biennium. And then the funding that we got with the help of Senator Winters and Mr. Prinz was $130,935. We had the money from criminal justice to pay for treatment, but what we did not have was a coordinator. And without a coordinator who can maintain the files and input the information into the database so that you can get accurate and reliable statistics was not in the local budget. And so we were in the position of having to close both our drug court and mental health court as a result of that. And I believe there were four other counties besides our county in that situation. And so Senator Winters answered my call first. Several other representatives and senators did as well. But she was able to work with Mr. Prinz and get us some one-time, I think there were federal stimulus funds that has paid for our coordinator. The treatment dollars have been coming through the Criminal Justice Commission, but the position of the coordinator is one that's included in OJD's budget. And I think that there's an option package that OJD has that would pay for those if they're restored to funding in all other areas. But we're essentially in the same situation as we're facing July 1 this year.
Yes.
Just as a follow-up, if the funding isn't renewed, what do you see the future looking like in terms of where these individuals go and how the outcomes are likely to be different?
Well, we would have to terminate our courts because our coordinator maintains all the files, serves all the administrative functions, works with the people who are on medication-assisted treatment. I haven't mentioned that, but essentially they're the opiate addicts, and then inputs all the information into the database from which data is mined to come up with the research. So we would be in a position of having to close both courts. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, the second part of my question was what's likely to happen to the folks who are in the drug court, who are referred to drug court, if that option isn't available?
Well, for future people to be referred, they would unfortunately just be told that there is no drug court in existence. In terms of those people that are in the program, we addressed that 2 years ago because we didn't want to penalize them in terms of sort of pulling the rug out from under them, if you will. And so we had worked with the treatment provider to continue the treatment and reduce the number of times we see them per month. The probation department was going to continue with the UAs, and they were going to get the benefit of the doubt, but we would not be able to maintain the files like we have, input the data in the database, and we'd probably have to cut out the medication-assisted treatment.
Thank you.
You want to follow up?
I just want to follow up on that since I've been, you know, close to it, and actually started on it a lot of years ago when we visited Seattle, a group of individuals from Marion County, including the DA and others. We went up there to see how they were addressing the issue of the mentally ill and some of these issues that Judge Graves is talking about. And I think what we'll see an impact on other parts of the system. You're going to see also the impact on the jails. When we start talking about mental health, it was talking about that person who has been in the jail 68 times and the individuals that who are concurrent both with mental health and drugs. So I think you're going to see them in the other parts of the system. And some of them will end up in our DOC.
Senator Close.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Judge Graves, I appreciate your work in this area. I can see that it's very interesting, very rewarding for you. But I, too, am interested in the funding because when I've told my counties about what you're doing, their response has generally been, well, you know, that's because you're getting grants that they don't feel they really have access to or are able to compete for because they're small counties. So I'm wondering, with counties, especially the counties that are getting the federal timber payments for, you know, the ONC counties,
sure,
their revenues are declining. So in Linn County, they've actually had to close a whole wing, so they've lost 48 beds. So I'm concerned that, you know, that we keep our general operating expenses going. I don't know if we can afford, and maybe you can enlighten me, if we can afford to do these special courts and avoid losing beds because of costs.
I understand your question. Certainly a good point. Actually, the study that was commissioned by the Criminal Justice Commission, and which you probably have had access to and have reviewed, showed that for every $1 spent in drug court in the 22 courts that were surveyed, there was a saving of $2.46. So I think it's a net savings to the state. In terms of those smaller counties, Craig Prinz could speak to that, but I believe several of those smaller counties received state criminal justice grants, and so I think they're being served with those. I don't think county dollars, but for the sheriff's contribution of the parole and probation officer and perhaps some health department counseling dollars. I don't believe those are coming out of county funds.
Okay. Thank you.
Chair. I just was going to, if I could help answer that, it's my understanding that the CJC provided $8 million in stopgap funding for this biennium, and that's the money that is due to expire. So without some other source of reinvestment, that's the money that's going to disappear and will impact not just Marion County, but the other counties that have relied on it.
And just for clarification, Josh, my understanding from the governor's budget of the $40 million that's projected for savings, $9 million was for drug courts, if I remember correctly. And I'm assuming
yes,
this is would be what would be going toward the courts that are in operation now and possibly others that could come online. And I've got Mr. Prinz in the back nodding in a upward and downward as a yes, that's it. Okay. All right. Other question? Senator Close, did you have any other questions?
No, thank you.
Anyone else?
One other comment on that.
Yes.
I think that would provide the treatment dollars, but we still would not have the coordinator position in at least five counties that we need to and must have in order to continue the courts.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Judge Waller.
Co-chairs, my name is Nan Waller. I'm the presiding judge in Multnomah County, and I've given you just a very brief, I apologize, I would have done something a little bit more thorough, outline of our treatment court and problem-solving courts. These are all specialty courts. The top four, STOP, which is Sanctions, Treatment, Opportunity, Progress, is a drug treatment court. START, Success Through Accountability, Restitution, and Treatment, is a drug treatment court focusing on felony property and drug offenders. DISP is an intensive supervision program for offenders who have two or more convictions for driving under the influence. And we have a mental health court, which is a deferred prosecution court with mental health caseworkers maintaining the clients in the community. All four of these courts are run on the principles of and are maintained fidelity to the treatment court model. The courts below, which I've titled as problem-solving courts, are also courts that have a problem-solving focus. So they are similar to treatment courts in that there are people who are connecting the offenders to services in the community, who are doing some monitoring, and are looking for those looking at the underlying problems that are bringing people before the court. For those courts, we have a domestic violence court. We have a coordinator that comes out of our budget who does an excellent job of connecting people to the services that they need, to jobs, to mental health treatment, to domestic violence intervention counseling. The child support court also has a coordinator. We realize that we were at the local level, and I know that you're focusing on prison, but we are using a tremendous number of jail beds for locking people up for not paying child support, which was rather, we were undermining ourselves and our own progress. We have a coordinator who then meets with and connects people to jobs programs, to housing, to the kinds of things that are barriers to employment. We have seen a tremendous, we've seen a reduction in the use of jail beds and a tremendous uptick in the collection of child support. As an adjunct to that, working with Family Court Services, who received a grant to put into place parenting time plans for those individuals where there was no parenting time plan who were in the child support program. Seeing that as a potential motivator for people to continue to pay their support. We have a couple of community courts. Our community courts started in 1998. These are for low-level quality of life offenses where through the work of our local public safety coordinating council, we've seen a tremendous amount of time and effort of law enforcement and other community providers in dealing with a population that just rotates through the jails, through our systems, through the courts. This court allows people to take responsibility, participate in community service, and be hooked up to social services if that is what is necessary, if drug and alcohol or mental health issues. As part of that, we've opened up, we've worked with other community stakeholders and now have a community court in the Bud Clark Commons because we realize there is a group of people who are absolutely repetitive and taking up a tremendous amount of time, and they are people who are homeless who need services on site. So the court has moved into the Bud Clark Commons. And we have a domestic violence deferred sentencing program, which if people, it's a pre-adjudication court, which allows for people who are successful in complying with the conditions that are laid out to have the charges dismissed. The theme, both in our treatment courts and our problem-solving courts, is that there are people who are providing connection, that we are looking for not just resolution of the case, but outcomes that will better serve both the community and the individual, and that we are trying to address the underlying issues that have brought the person into the criminal justice system. All of these we have felt are very successful. I want to tell you about two courts that are not on here yet because they are not yet in place. We realize that our veterans are tremendous. We want to make sure that they're getting the service that they need and that they are getting the benefits that they are entitled to. We don't have the capacity to start a veterans court, but we've been working with all of our community stakeholders to start a veterans docket. The VA has agreed that they will have somebody who will be the connector to veterans services because we know that we are using the people are getting in through some of our other treatment courts, getting services through the county where they are otherwise entitled to veteran services. So we see that as a potential. Not only are we getting people aligned to the right services, and the navigator will work with other social service agencies to take care of some of the underlying issues, but we'll get people connected to the services that they are entitled to based upon their service. We also have a new pilot that has been another collaborative, and that's the other theme with all of our treatment courts and our problem-solving courts. All of these are bringing all of the stakeholders to the public safety system together to work together to come up with a solution. So all of these courts have some kind of regularity of meetings of the stakeholders so that we're really all on the same page and not working at cross purposes. We have a pilot that will be starting on March 15th, the Effective Resolution Project, which is going to target gang members who otherwise would have presumptive prison sentences, so not level one offenses, measure 11 offenses, but level two. There will be assessments through the Department of Community Justice that will really provide the level of information that judges need and district attorneys need, as well as defense attorneys, to better craft sentences. The goal is to have more effective sentencing. There will be a judicial, and quite frankly, earlier, because we also know that we don't want to, we have, at least in our county, we've had a problem for the past year where we are releasing people from jail on an emergency population release on a regular basis over the past year. And while we are studying that, we know that there's some things that resolution of cases more quickly will certainly help that piece of the problem. At about 45 days into the case, we will have had the assessments done, and there will be a judicial settlement conference, which will be bringing together the judge, the DA, the offender, and the defense attorney to try to fashion a sentence that will meet the needs of the community in terms of public safety and meet the underlying issues of this population. And this is a, as you all know, the gang issue in Portland has been something that we've been struggling with. We have mentors in the community who've been working with a misdemeanor gang population who have all agreed to have lunch with our misdemeanor gang population as a way of making the face-to-face relationship that we know really for many people who are in the criminal justice system is truly what they lack, a relationship with somebody who will help them navigate through the life that they've chosen to a better life. So we are hoping that we can perhaps get the mentors to agree in our effective resolution project to also be available so that we have people from the community helping their way back. We're hooked up with services through the work being done through Mercy Corps, so there's going to be a wide variety of services that are available after the assessments to better craft sentences. For the past 4 weeks, we have had a group that's been meeting district attorney, sheriff's office, Department of Community Justice, judges, defense lawyers, Suzanne Hayden with the Citizens Crime Commission, to really, Steve Novak from the city, to look at if there is the possibility of any kind of reinvestment funding coming our way. How are we best going to use that so that we meet the goals of reducing stay in prison or prison beds and maintain our community safety and address the needs of the people who are coming before us so that we know in terms of long-term that recidivism. And so We're working on a plan. We see the Effective Resolution Project as that model, as a cornerstone of our plan, because the early resolution with better information for judges is certainly the evidence-based practice that we believe will lead to the dual, the multiple goals of reducing use of prison beds, keeping the community safe, not overwhelming our local jails, and providing better outcomes. That's it.
All right. Well, thank you. Questions?
Yeah. Senator?
Yes.
So I am really curious. I didn't realize, you know, Judge Waller, that you're moving forward with the Effective Resolution Project.
Yes.
Interesting.
Yes.
What size population are you talking about that you're focused at?
Oh, now I should have the number in front of me, and it's probably in my computer. I can't tell you what our initial pilot is. The gang population was chosen because it was seen as a small enough population, and I will get you the number that they are believing will be the beginning number that we will start with. And it's, of course, a much higher number that we need to assess in order to get to the number that will actually be involved in the pilot.
Yeah, I just want to say I think that's a good movement. toward that. I mean, especially the impact that that has, the far, how far-reaching that is.
And that, like with the other models, we're trying to limit the numbers of judges involved, limit the number of DAs involved, defense lawyers, so that really we have a, POs. We have a group of people who are all on the same page, and this came out of, there were a number of communities that sent from Oregon that sent teams to Reno for to learn about evidence-based practices, and this is what our team came up with. So we're very excited.
Representative Garrett.
Thank you, and I'm sorry you said this and I missed it, but what's the extent of your reliance on state funding for these courts?
Well,
versus, the, I mean, the one-time money that, that
some of it, some of the coordinator positions we are paying for because we see it as effective. So in terms of reliance, you know, that's as we've made cuts, we have, because we believe in the results that we get and the long-term outcomes for the community of our treatment courts and problem-solving courts, we've maintained those coordinators. A number of the courts don't have coordinators that are being paid for through our funding, but some of them do. And so that is something that we, with every cut, we've looked at and worried that we may have to get there.
You know, I actually thought, I'm just kind of curious, I don't know, Craig might know this, I mean, he's aware of what CJC, you know, gives as grants to all the different, but I'm curious if CJC would also be aware of what, you know, the other portions of, you know, input are to reach. Okay. Thanks.
Thank you. Any other questions or comments?
I do have a question. Thank you, Co-Chair. On the gang, is any of the funds that we give through, I think it's going through DOJ, on gang intervention, is it any of those dollars used for the
court? For this new project? I don't know, and I can find that out for you. That pilot starts on March 15th. The misdemeanor gang pilot is being just done on through the good graces of people from the community who've stepped up. There is a group called 1145, a group of men in the community who decided that the gang violence, that they had a responsibility to the young men in their community. And so 1145 stands for 1 year, once a week, 45 minutes a time, and they're out in the community. And then as part of that, they also started, they agreed that they would start having lunch. And we have had some pretty remarkable stories where the lunch led to somebody being open to getting hooked up with services, to getting back into school. So these are our lower level, but we know that if we can manage at the lower level, obviously we will prevent the further climb the ladder into prison. So we're, it's very exciting to see the connection to the community and community really stepping up. A wonderful group of mentors and others from the community who are involved.
It's somewhat ironic that the number would be 1145,
but I don't even go there.
I know. At first I was very confused when I heard about that. 1145?
All right, any other questions or comments? Colleagues, I believe that concludes the presentations for today. Josh, do we have anything before Wednesday?
No, sir. Back Wednesday.
All right, so we'll be back here on Wednesday. Everyone, thank you for being here this afternoon. Safe travels home if you're going home, and have a wonderful weekend.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.